Okay, so now we're into low dimensional land, and some of this I think is just good spectroscopy, and some of the ideas that I wanted to tell you about are probably very speculative. Oh, that wasn't it. I'm sorry, I hit the wrong one. Now we'll have to wait for this thing to get all the slides up at the same time so that it can be in the view I didn't want. Oh, actually, we got it. Okay, cool. Well, I put this up to show you the people involved. This is the thesis work largely of Yihang Guan, who was with a postdoc with me for a little while, and now he too is a postdoc at the Advanced Light Source, and Jonathan Denlinger. We had a lot of interaction with Cliff Olson and Hartmann Hooks, and samples from Marcuse and Claire Schlenker in Grenoble, and also from Lynn Schneemeyer at Bell. And I won't, well, the main point I want to make, this is a little bit modified one. I just mentioned to you this issue that the photoelectron lifetime gives you a contribution to the perpendicular K. And that also generates an extra line width for 3D crystals. And that's one reason, again, why when you listen to talks on the cuprates, there's a whole bunch of stuff that issues that just don't ever surface, which, now that we're doing low-dimensional systems, are less important. And here are all these modes, and I already showed you Fermi surface maps and EBCs and stuff, and this time I'll also show you MBCs. That's momentum distribution curves in which you fix omega and you scan K, and that's turned out to be a popular thing, and I'll maybe do just a little bit of that. You all know this stuff about the TL Tolmanagel-Luttinger line shape, and it's different from Fermi liquids, and it has this funny property that if you K-integrate, you find that the spectral weight vanishes. Apologies to Kurt, I know this is a figure that maybe isn't the one that you would prefer for this particular phenomena, but it conveys the point that I wanted to make. And so, of course, it's very interesting. Can you really see things like this? And we've been trying to do that. I did want to remind you that for the anomalous exponent alpha greater than a half, the feature is edge-like. And for alpha less than a half, it's peak-like. And the peak-like case is shown here. And that's because we think we have an example where it's one way and the other way, depending on which compound we're looking at. So that's a qualitatively important point. So the experimental motivation for us, anyway, comes from the early 90s of angle-integrated photoemission. Well, this the angle-resolved work that Cliff Olson did on the high TC materials with the long tails and the suggestion that the long tails had something to do with non-Fermi liquid behavior and maybe with low-dimensional physics. And at the same time, Yves Baer's group in Neuchâtel studied angle-integrated photoemission for some low-dimensional systems. Here, some quasi-1D systems. This is the blue bronze and TA SE42I. And they found power laws that were suggestive of this vanishing of spectral weight at the chemical potential, but they worried that perhaps this might just be a symptom of some pseudo-gap behavior because these systems are CDW systems, and so they're going to go to a CDW, and they're one-dimensional, so you can imagine fluctuations producing something that would mimic this kind of behavior. And so we thought, well, maybe we can do angle-resolved work and get at the issue of what's happening.
I'm confused by the tantalum selenium 2 sample, which is here. As far as I know, this is not quasi-1D.
Yeah, no, this is a quasi-1D system.
No, I'm talking about the other one.
TASE2?
Yeah.
That one's a 2D system, and so it was shown here as an example of a Fermi edge.
Okay.
And similarly, the rubidium is a three-dimensional metal. And so both of those were shown as examples of Fermi edges. And this is a figure I took from one of Yves Baer's, the PRL that Dardel was the first author on. Really, really pioneering stuff, I think. I mean, I remember wishing I had done this and just really thinking this was nice, that they had this idea to get these materials and make these measurements. So we tried to study some systems that were not cuprates and were low-dimensional, just with a view of trying to get at this more. And this is a kind of, it's a slide that Yihong Guan made, in which he plotted what he called strangeness versus the dimensionality of the structure. And just as a kind of an idea, we were interested in trying to find a Fermi liquid reference material, and that's the system TITE2 that many people now study, and I won't show you much about that. And then there were these three molybdenum oxides, which were very much studied by Claire Schlenker and her colleagues, and also by other people, Martha Greenblatt, and probably other workers beyond that, colleagues of theirs, and so on and so forth. One I'll spend some time on is lithium molybdenum oxide. It's the so-called lithium purple, and it really is purple. It's a non-CDW system. That was why we were attracted to it, because it doesn't have the complications of an impending CDW transition. And it's for sure, I think, a non-Fermi liquid material. I won't talk about this one, which is the blue bronze, just because I didn't want to spend too much time on this topic. But I do want to tell you a little bit about that one. It's a quasi-2D system. It's a CDW system, and it has what's called hidden nesting. And I'll mention a little bit what that is as we get further along. And then sort of sitting out here are sort of two-dimensional and very strange cuprates that I will only say a little bit about. So this is just a quickie look at our old early PRL from 1992 with Rolf Claessen of TITE2 as a system that's a normal metal. It's low dimensional and is now studied now by many people to try to. It has the property of having an isolated band in K-space that you can try to study how the line shapes look as you go across the Fermi level. And they can be pretty well fit by a Fermi liquid self-energy if you're near the chemical potential, but not if you're far from the chemical potential. Then it's clear that down at the bottom of the band, this has a complicated shape, but that's okay if you're far away from the chemical potential. So I don't want to dwell on that, except I did want to introduce it because I use it as a standard later on for a particular thing that I want to show you. So lithium molybdenum oxide, the system that we got samples from Claire Schlenker, and I remember being in Grenoble and looking at her sample drawer, and there were some little bits there, and I wasn't sure whether they were really exciting pieces of material to study. And Claire said to me, you know, you're here in Grenoble, take the samples with you now while you can. Don't think about it and then write me a letter. You know, if you want to study this material, here are some samples. Take them with you. And of course, I followed her advice, and I did, and we studied the material, and I think we were really fortunate. So I owe Claire a great deal for the encouragement, I think, to really look at this material. So it's a quasi-1D system. There's a mystery phase below 24 Kelvin. The reason why people believe there's a phase transition is that the specific heat, delta C over T, shows a little peak here in this vicinity, but it's just a little peak. What other things do you see? Other than that little humpy thing in the specific heat, you see an upturn in the resistivity, and the CDW community kind of wanted for that to be a CDW transition, but it hasn't worked out that the other signatures of a CDW could be seen. And in particular, Leo DiGiorgi did optical spectroscopy on this at 300K and 4K and temperatures in between, and saw no change in the spectrum. This is not the low temperature one, it's a fit, but the main point is the reflectivity spectrum down to a millivolt that doesn't show you any sign of a gap. And nothing develops at low temperatures, and I think I believe Leo's data on this point. If you look at the magnetic susceptibility, it's essentially flat, and nothing happens through the transition, and that would be another sign of a gap. And then if you actually look at this resistivity uprise and you treat this as the sign of a gap, it turns out that the magnitude of the gap you would get is something like 0.2 millivolt, which is far away from the energy scale you would need in a mean field theory, a typical CDW theory, to connect it up to a CDW transition, if that's what you thought this was. So, and then finally, Puget has repeatedly returned to this problem from over the years, trying to find some evidence of ordering, and he tells me he doesn't think it's there. And that's been done, repeated again in 2001. So I think it's a fair statement that this system doesn't have a CDW, and so one says it has a mystery phase below 24K. It is a 1.9 Kelvin superconductor. In this region, the transport properties are nominally consistent with Luttinger liquid. So C sub phi proportional to temperature, such a term exists in the specific heat, although there are other terms in the specific heat as well. The susceptibility is a constant, and at least some theories of Luttinger liquid produce resistivity linear in T. And this is the linear resistivity in this regime, pretty linear up to 250 Kelvin that measurement's been done. Kind of reminiscent of the high TCs, and I'll show you something like that. Maybe a little bit later for other ones of these systems. We've studied.
Can we see the optics again? Can we see the optical conductivity?
Yeah.
So we had last week a lot of discussion about some power laws, which were the best signature for Luttinger liquid behavior. Is that observing the conductivity? I mean, this reflectivity, one has to do some Kramers-Kronig.
I think Leo has not interrogated his old data. You'll notice that the data on here is 1988. To my knowledge, he has not. He has not addressed that issue. And so I think it's just an open question.
Okay.
His paper in the literature focuses on the issue of, is it a CDW? That was the context in which he did his study at the time. It's a good point.
And how about the resistivity perpendicular to the EZ axis?
It's much smaller, but maybe still. I have that data probably lurking around. Yeah, much larger. I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. Much larger, and is it an insulator? I'm sorry. I should know the answer to that, and I don't. I'm sure I have it buried in a slide hidden someplace that has more detail. Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't pull it out of my memory, but one would like to know. So we have looked at the temperature dependence in angle integrated photoemission just to see what that does. So this is the analog of the experiment that Yves Baer and his group did on their one-dimensional systems. This is a big band of stuff associated with oxygens. And then the interesting stuff lies up in this vicinity, and that's the part that's built out of molybdenum B states. And essentially, the way these materials work, the lithium is a dopant that gives up electrons to these molybdenum D states that hang around up above the big oxygen band. That's the way the thing works. And so what one sees here is, again, no Fermi edge and no gap-like feature. And then as you change the temperature, you see a kind of sharpening up. And that's now from 250 Kelvin kind of down to 12 Kelvin done on a beamline at the SRC. These samples are much easier to work with from the point of view of being size and homogeneity and nicely cleaved. They have the property that they tend to damage if the photon energy is too high. So that's the hazard, that's the difficulty of working with these materials. This is done in our home lab with a helium-1 lamp. Just comparing at 300 and 113, and you're supposed to take away the message that we did it in two different places and got the same answer. So the thrust of this is to say no Fermi edge, no gap, and no dramatic temperature dependence as you go through this phase transition.
I don't remember the scale you had on the resistivity axis of the previous slide. Is it a good measure along the chain?
Well, let's see. This says arbitrary units. I think I had that question once before. They're not great metals, but they're not going to be exceeding some limit of mean free path less than a lattice constant. Or, you know, they're not going to be like that. But they're not great metals. I think that's a fair statement. This is a Fermi surface map taken from the lithium purple. I show you two maps. This is one in which we are varying the angles for
coming to the previous, so you can extract something like n of omega as a function of omega from the previous slide.
Actually, one can fit some of these right near the chemical potential. You can make fits to determine an alpha. So there is a power law onset, and I'll mention that to you. I'll show you better about that in a bit. So to try to establish really one-dimensional, this is Fermi surface map taken by scanning two angles, and so we're parallel to the surface. And this is one which was done by fixing one angle and then scanning photon energy, so that moves us on these circular arcs and one angle. So that's an attempt to, and it's not just an attempt, it is a measurement of the Fermi surface perpendicular to the sample. So we're trying to look in three dimensions now to say to ourselves, yes, this is really a one-dimensional system as best as we can measure it. I think that the blurriness and the indistinct character has maybe something to do with the fact that there's not just a heck of a lot of weight at the chemical potential. So we're just looking at that little dab of weight at the chemical potential that I'm about to show you. This is the band structure calculated by Huangbo, who has generated most of the known electronic structure calculation of these systems. They have large unit cells, can't tell you how many atoms, but lots. And the LDA community was not eager to work on them for quite a long time. And so Huangbo is a chemist, a theoretical chemist, who has some intuition about how to attack the problem from the point of view of maybe something a little bit like tight binding band theory, although that's probably too simple a description. But he can identify the active chemical bands, the ones near the chemical potential, and he has, I think, had a great deal of success in these materials building up pictures of the electronic structure. So this is the band structure that he calculated. There are two bands crossing the chemical potential. They actually come together and are degenerate here. That's an accidental degeneracy. It has to do with weak coupling between certain of the chains in the unit cell that generate this stuff. That's the Brillouin zone. So this now, I'm going to show you a spectrum along gamma to y. So that's along this direction. We'll see these bands and we'll see those bands. And then we'll look at the line shape as we cross the chemical potential. So here are the AB bands that are for us a nuisance set of bands because they come in an energy range where we would kind of like not to have anything because we'd like to look at the line shape. But we try to pick regions where we can study where these guys aren't too close to the chemical potential. This is the C band, and there's just a hint of the D band here. If we look at other places in K-space or with different photon energies, we can find places where both the C and the D bands are of comparable intensity. In this case, we wanted to try to study one of them crossing the chemical potential with a view that the theories we have are one-band theories, and we're going to hope that, in some sense, I guess the two bands are independent. But anyway, under these conditions, this is one band particularly visible. And then we've replotted the line shapes as we come to the chemical potential so that they fall on top of one another. This is the B band that never crosses the chemical potential, and this is the C band, and these are the line shapes as it approaches the chemical potential. This is K equals K Fermi, the red one, and then the green ones here correspond to K greater than K Fermi, and these guys are K less than K Fermi. And we have compared it here to a calculation for the Tolmanoga-Luttinger model, this one done for finite temperature. It's worked by Orgad, who was probably a postdoc at UCLA. And the essential idea, if I understand it right, was to invoke quantum criticality as the way in which the temperature dependence was going to be calculated. Turned out for us that it was important to have a finite T theory because the details of how the features are smeared out actually were, well, when we were working with the T equals zero theories, there were kinks and things in the spectra that were predicted to be there, which we really didn't see. And so This is done for a particular choice of alpha, 0.9, which in fact turns out to be consistent with that angle integrated spectra I'll show you in a moment. The Hollon velocity is twice the spin-on velocity, and I'll show you some comparisons in a minute of what happens if you change these parameters. And we don't plot them on top of one another, but we think by eye it's not so bad. So these would be, in this picture, these are spin-on edges moving here at a certain velocity, and Hollon peaks moving with a certain velocity. Alpha is greater than a half, so it's an edge and not a peak. Here's the K equals K Fermi, and then the retreat, or the retraction, I guess, of the spectral weight is the green compared with the green.
But it seems that there should be, for a given K, there should be both a Hollon peak and a spin-on peak, right?
In this regime for alpha, you have a spin-on edge and a Hollon peak. So
where is the, in the theory, I don't see where the for both peaks.
So this is the edge, and that's the peak. Yeah, and if I would show you at t equals zero, you would see a sharp onset, which would then decay, and then it would come up to a peak and then decay. And the finite temperature were really important for us. That, I mean, we didn't see those features, and so one way you say, oh, it just doesn't work.
No, but shouldn't you expect that the Hollon peak should be much more strongly temperature dependent than the spin-on peak?
I have no idea what you expect. I do know that you know, this is the result of an accurate evaluation of the theoretical guidance that we got.
Than the spin velocity.
No, apparently it's the double.
Other way around.
Oh,
yeah, charge is larger.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Factor two.
Uh-huh. All right.
And there is no sign of a shadow band, because one of the features of the last injury that you have two bands from, let's say, from K less than KF, the Hollon on the spin on the, from the other side, you should see something which is a shadow band having only the Hollon part. There is no sign of that here.
You have these bands A and B.
No, just the same band. You should see. Let's say from, if you take the Hollon part, there is a part which is a given K, and the other part which is a K, which is so you see a shadow band.
No, but if you start with KF, then you will see. If you continue the band, you will see the shadow part much lower in energy.
No. We'll be just at the same point.
They will be
just a shadow band going away in the other direction. Probably alpha is very near one. Probably the weight is very small.
They are both at negative frequency.
Yeah, because
it's speed.
Yeah,
which is essentially when you were presenting the data for the Tomolak, there was something on the positive energy, there's something on the other energy for a given. This one. Then when you cross the Fermi energy, essentially they're transverse. So you have the two peaks on high energy, so they are invisible. You should see instead this edge on low energy.
So maybe what you have in mind, if I understand you, is that, I mean, this weight,
yeah,
is the, you know, moving outward from the chemical potential. Is that little dab of stuff?
Okay, you should see that when there is the crossing.
So this is K greater than K Fermi.
Yeah.
So in some sense, the peak is over here now,
yeah,
and there's stuff left behind,
yeah,
and that's the stuff within,
yeah,
this picture.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is the calculated amount of that stuff.
Okay, good. But also the weight.
If that's what you had in mind.
Yeah, you cannot be this.
But Claudio, I mean, the weight could be also quite different.
Yeah, the weight is quite difficult, for sure, it's quite difficult.
Could you say a bit more precisely what this guy actually considered in his calculation? Was it just a solution of the Latin-Tomonaga-Latinger model, putting in these parameters?
Yeah, of course, because alpha is very small.
It would be my understanding that I should say yes, and that there's a finite temperature, but what I think ORGAD did was to start with the zero temperature solutions of the Tomonaga-Luttinger model and then to invoke quantum criticality in order to say what should be the evolution with temperature. That's what I think is.
The model can also be solved quite easily at finite temperature. It's not a big deal.
That's what you did.
The question is whether the parameters somehow are also assumed to be temperature dependent, coming from microscopy somehow. But probably he put in just a constant parameters.
Constant parameters.
The temperature dependence is due to.
Yes.
Statistical weight in this solving
yes.
This model.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes.
Doing it numerically is no problem. It's just a question if you want an analytical formula.
So we ended up using the analytical formula to evaluate the line shapes. Of course, that's a handy thing for us as experimentalists wanting to be able to generate something that we can compare to.
But he probably sort of neglected the fact that when coming from some microscopic system, this Luttinger model is just sort of the fixed point you reach really in the zero temperature limit. And it's, of course, all a question how fast you get there. And that builds the temperature dependent. So this is certainly not included. It's, of course, a complicated thing.
For us, it was kind of a step function forward, I guess, to add the temperature. Because, of course, we were always confronted when we compared to the zero temperature. People say, but you're measuring at some finite temperature and you can't make this comparison. And indeed, it did turn out that there were significant predicted differences in the sharpness of the features and so on that made a whopping big difference in the...
That even solving just this Luttinger model, there is some temperature dependence in there.
Okay, just to give you some sense of what happens if we change the ratio of the two velocities, this is the data, and this was what we reckoned to be the best choice. If I make it 1-to-1, then the comparison. Oh, and then these are plotted in such a we have changed the Fermi so that the Holon peak always matches the peak in the data, and then we're asking the question, how does the edge move? That's the concept of the transparency. And so in this case, if I make it 1-to-1, then it's pretty clear the edge spacing here is too big. If I make it 1.5, it's still too big. If I make it 2, it looks pretty good by eye. If I go to 3, it's pretty clear that the edge spacing is less than in the spectrum. And if I go to 4, it's really clear. So this just to try to show you the extent to which there's some tension between the choice of this parameter and the data, and to say that there are two features moving in that the edge and the peak move differently within the data. This is playing around with the alpha value, and the kind of thing that we look at here the thing that Gihong has focused on is how much weight is there at the chemical potential relative to the peak for the K equals K Fermi spectrum. And so this is 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, and 1.0. So they're always greater than 0.5, so that it's an edge-like feature. And you need pretty big alphas in order to get amounts of weight that look like the data. And that turns out to be fine for us because I'll show you in a little bit that we would infer a big alpha value from the angle integrated photo emission spectrum. So I'd say there's a lot less tension here vis-a-vis the choice of alpha than we have in the case of how we choose the Holon spin-on velocity ratio for describing that data.
So this alpha equal 1 indicates a very, very strong correlation.
One would think so. Mm. I mean, that's a traditional issue that always comes up, that the alpha values you tend to measure by almost any means in these materials tend to be bigger than you'd feel comfortable with from microscopic models. I think that's a true statement, although Kurt has addressed that issue in looking at coupled chains and maybe other people as well, but I know the paper that Kurt and his collaborators wrote about that issue, and you could find big alpha values for a coupled Luttinger chain system. So it seemed I took away from that paper that maybe I shouldn't be too hung up about this issue of the size of the alpha value.
Yeah.
So in the short range, if you write down some purely 1D short range interacting model, typically the alpha values are quite small. So it's sort of striking that all these, especially these photo emission experiments, they usually find these very big alpha values.
Yeah.
So it will be really important to try to confirm that by just measuring something else, which would probe that alpha.
Yes, I'm going to show you that in a second. One other thing, and we're trying to do some temperature-dependent measurements to look for quantum criticality now on that lithium purple system over a wide temperature range, and how that'll.
Interdimensional states can give you this alpha, no?
Yeah, I'm going to. I just haven't. I'm working my way towards that. I'm sorry. I my choice of sequence isn't quite what your mind would like. Okay, I want to mention to you a quasi-2D system. It is a CDW system. It's known as displaying hidden one-dimensionality, and the reason is that if you look, as Huang Bo did, at the way in which the atoms arrange themselves, you can realize that it consists of three chains which are weakly coupled to one another. And so you can actually, you know, this is just the band structure, and if you just look at the band structure, it's not obvious to you that there's some kind of topology to the system. But if you look at the Fermi surface actually consists of three sets of parallel lines which are generated, which are sort of built into this band structure calculation they did. And this is the Fermi surface map that we measured. And you can see what the best wave vector for CDW is going to be. It's this one. And that's literally the wave vector that's seen in X-ray diffraction at the charge density wave transition, because that nests this with this and this with this, and then you simply don't get rid of that piece of Fermi surface when you form the CDW in this system. So this is an interesting system because it's two-dimensional, but it has some very obvious one-dimensionality lurking around in there. And when we first looked at the line shapes for this system, this was again collaboration with Claire Schenker, I have to say that it was hard from looking at these line shapes, which were measured along various directions in K-space, to really identify the bands that were dispersing to give the chemical potential. And it really wasn't until we looked at the Fermi surface maps, till we measured those, that we were quite convinced that some aspects of this band calculation had to be present in the data. And I want to return to these funny line shapes in just a little bit. So now I want to sort of get speculative to some extent, or maybe you'll say to a large extent, and say that the struggle to try to find evidence of fractionalization has been hard. It's hard to find materials where you can just take one of these toy models and look at the spectra and just map them on to what you see. And so I didn't show you, for example, the blue bronze, if that's another quantum 1D system where there's some evidence for spin charge separation from some of the transport properties, and it might be a spin gap system, so maybe you would think about a different model Hamiltonian than Polonago-Luttinger. But anyway, our experience has been that when we try to walk up to data with a toy model and just say, can we make the picture work? The answer is usually no. The lithium purple is as close as anything, and there is an aspect of that data that actually doesn't look like the Tolmanogalottinger line shape. So we tried to look for generalized signatures in these theories, maybe encouraged a little bit in this by Steve Kibbleson, who had identified one such one in a PRL that he wrote with CX Chen. So here are the four that I want to quickly pass by you. So vanishing weight at the Fermi level, so no quasi-particle, and some kind of power laws, which we associate with an alpha. I mentioned the Anderson-Wren power law line shape tails, and I'll just show you that one, which again is associated with an anomalous dimension, but it can't be gotten out of the Luttinger liquid. Two or more objects moving at different speeds, so some evidence that you fractionalize the electron into density waves or some kind of two-particle excitations. And then this concept that Kibbleson and his guys were responsible for putting forth, that you still have a sharp momentum distribution curve, so sharp Fermi surfaces, but the EDCs are all spread out as a result of the fractionalization. And this is for at Fermi energy and Fermi wave vector. And that this is kind of intrinsic to the situation, even if you don't get the details right. I mean, that was the idea that was put forth. So I wanted to show you this angle integration stuff and contrast TIT2, our Fermi surface material, with the lithium purple bronze. So this is the result of progressively integrating over more and more angles the line shapes measured near the chemical potential. So here's K Fermi, which is sort of peaky and certainly has weight at the chemical potential. And as you K integrate, it really goes over into the Fermi edge, and it really looks like the Fermi edge we would expect to get. This stuff falling away here is because actually the line width of this TITE2D band isn't very great. It only goes 200 or 300 millivolts below the chemical potential. On the other hand, if I take the lithium purple data and I angle integrate that, you see it also certainly has weight at the chemical potential. It's not as though there's no weight in the K integrated spectrum. But as you progressively angle integrate, there isn't enough weight there to integrate up to an edge. Instead, you integrate up to a power law. And in fact, one can deduce a power law with an alpha value that's about 0.9 by fitting this edge up to this little kink here. And the little kink is the place where we start to run into the bands that are at higher energies, the AB bands that I mentioned to you. So even though you can't beautifully resolve in all detail with perfect K, the system knows that there's something different about these line shapes and these line shapes, because when you K integrate, you get quite different angle integrated spectra.
Right, but the thing is the intensity is not going to zero, it seems. It's going to a constant.
Oh, this will be a zero, yeah.
Is a zero?
Yeah, it really is. They're just trying to show you the shape there. So it's not that there's extra stuff up there.
Oh, no, with the temperature. So just the weight, the number hits zero, it gets
to the alpha. So to demonstrate...
It's convoluted with the Fermi function, essentially.
Actually, this is taken from the ORGAD theory. So yes.
The finite temperature, the integrated, I have a 93 paper for the main where we have the formulas for the integrated stuff for finite temperature. And then, it's very simple.
We probably missed it. I mean, we may not. So we ended up drawing very much on ORGAD's paper because it probably came at the time when we were ready to need something. And I was talking to Steve, and Steve said, "Read this paper." So we did. So vanishing K-summed weight. Here's a collection of stuff. Here are Tominaga-Luttinger line shapes, calculated for a variety of alphas, and of course for alpha equals zero you get the Fermi edge, and for alpha equals one it's very obviously not Fermi liquid-like. Now, this is the quasi-1D lithium purple bronze with the alpha equals 0.9. This is actually the blue bronze. I haven't showed you this data, but this has an alpha of 0.7. And interesting, here's the quasi-2D system with the hidden nesting. This one actually has an alpha of 0.3. We are absolutely convinced that the best fit does not come from a Fermi edge for this quasi-2D system, but that it's a small but non-zero alpha. And I care about that because I'm going to try and make an argument to you in just a moment. And it was really important for us to use the non-zero temperature theory for that. Interestingly enough, bismuth 2212 done along a particular direction in K-space where we had data, angle integrated along that line does, within the resolution and so on and so forth, produce an alpha of zero. And just would have liked, of course, to have some non-zero alpha, but that's how it came out. And this is the TITE2, all done with the same kind of fitting and kind of, minimizing an R value and that sort of thing. So why did I show you that stuff? What? Oh, I see. This is a construction of the Anderson-Wren line shape. Sorry, too cute. Since you guys know this already, the basic idea that Phil put forward when he looked at the high TC data in the early days was that he thought that it would all sort of have an envelope that was a common power law tail relative to the origin and then be interrupted. There's probably some little thing here. Yeah, sorry, this is kind of clunky. But there would be a break point at epsilon of k, and then he sort of drew a straight line down there. And he had in mind, I think, that one would get this from the Tolmanogi-Luttinger or Luttinger liquid kind of ideas. I believe that's a true statement. So as you had different epsilons of k's, you would see this kind of a line shape was what he saw when he looked at Cliff Olson's data. And actually, it's true. You can, if you plot that data, scaling it so that it is matched here, then you will find that the tails do like that. And then here are these breaks that come down like this. This is probably, this is the Kaminsky data from 2001 that he kindly gave us so that we could plot it up in this way. And you will get an alpha value of 0.42, which is certainly different from zero. So this particular effort to try to find, it was put forth as part of the proposal from Anderson and Wren that we should link this to the alpha in this way. I think that's underived, so it's just part of the ansatz that they put forth. But if we do that, then for the bismuth 2212, which is what Phil was looking at, that's the alpha that you would get.
Because the ansatz to the left was produced by staring for a very long time at the early Olson data.
Yes, no, I think it should be seen as a way to think about the data. I think that's, we call it a visualization, and Phil hasn't objected to my use of that term, and I think that's a reasonable way to say. If you do this for TITE2, for sure you will not find that the tails of the TITE2 data do anything like this. I mean, they just don't. They are well fit by Fermi liquid theory. Interestingly enough, it doesn't work for Luttinger liquid either, and you know right away the reason. It's because the Luttinger liquid singularity moves with epsilon k. So the power laws are always with respect to this point where the break point comes, not with respect to the Fermi energy. So it's as though there's something special about the Fermi energy within this framework. And we have not been able to understand any way to just get that directly out of Luttinger liquid kinds of ideas. But we were emboldened to try the scheme for some of our other quasi-low-dimensional systems. In the lithium purple, it's a little bit hard to do a good job because there is these other bands that get in the way. We have tried to subtract them out approximately, and there are tricks where we can do that. But we rather think that this feature of the line shapes is seen in the lithium purple also. And if so, in this respect, it does not fit the Tolmanogi-Luttinger line shape, even though these other aspects seem to be not so bad. Here's the purple bronze. This one, actually, both of these sets, there are two peaks that cross the chemical potential, and this yields an alpha value, which is about 0.7, which is not too different from the one that you get from the angle integrated spectrum for that one. I'll show you what happens for the hidden one-dimensional system in a minute. This is this idea of a narrow NDC and a wide EDC, and this is the picture taken directly out of the paper that was written with Orgad and Kibbleson and ZX Shen, and they offered up some data from a stripy cuprate as an example of this sort of thing. But the concept is that if you look for the Fermi energy, you look along the k-axis, it's sharp, but if you pick K Fermi and you look along the energy axis, it's broad. And this is our data for the lithium purple. I already showed you sharp Fermi surfaces, and so if you scan along here, you see a sharp feature. If on the other hand you sit at K Fermi and then you look, the EDC is spread out. So this is the MDC, and this is a theory again from Orgad's paper. I don't understand the little shift here, although we have speculations about what that might be, but maybe for our purposes you won't be too bothered by that. And then this is the EDC with its spread out character, and again, this is the theory that we would get from that temperature dependence. In the K-purple, we don't, in the blue bronze, we don't try to fit it, but we try to show you that there are, in this case, two bands crossing, which can be resolved in a Fermi surface map, and again, a very smeared out EDC. So that that aspect of the line shape seems to be there.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
In the ITC, actually, the stripe interpretation is not completely clear, because actually in data you see X and Y Fermi surface topologies, which look one-dimensional, and you may interpret them as saying there are regions in the 2D system, carboxide plane, which have stripes in X and then alternating with stripes in Y direction. But this is just one possibility. And so the stripe interpretation is not unique, so to speak, in the ITC. Here you don't have this. These Fermi surfaces are really quasi 1D and have not an XY rotation symmetry.
Yes. The system that ZX showed data for in that PRL, I think, was one of the static stripe systems, neodymium, strontium, da 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 da, rather than one of the, you know, the live cuprates. So I think they thought that it was a good example to show. So we think, if you will allow me some freedom within this generalized signatures argument, that I can find all of those signatures in the quasi-2D hidden one-dimensional data. So this is the data looking along M to K prime. So that's this here. And this Fermi surface crossing is the one that corresponds to this dispersing peak. And when we first looked at this data, we were really puzzled by the presence of this other stuff in the spectrum. But I mean, there is clearly a dispersing peak that produces a well-defined Fermi surface crossing that we see in the map. If we measure the angle-integrated photoemission spectrum, we can fit it with alpha of 0.3. So I showed you the power law onset already, but just to count them up. If we look at this Anderson-Wren line shape, we think that we can find here the same kind of line shape behavior that we see in the high TCs. And also in some of the other low D systems, even though it's a 2D system. So there is some kind of tail behavior here with lines here that break away. And that gives us an alpha of 0.4 as to be compared with an alpha of 0.3 gotten from so they're not so different. And here at least are beginning to be alphas that are less than a half. And we care about that because we actually have a peaky thing moving in the spectrum. I want now to come to the hard part of the argument, which I don't know how you'll take it, but look, I think it's really funny to understand these backgrounds. Here we have a system where the band we're looking at is well isolated from the background band structure, the oxygen stuff. It's entirely confined to a region well away from the oxygen stuff. So we can look over the entire bandwidth. You have always some kind of K-independent, rather flat background for always present in the spectra. So how would I understand such a thing? It's not inelastic scattering. It's nothing to do with the photoemission process, because that produces inelastic tails that continue on and are not nicely confined to the bandwidth. In the cuprates, you actually can't see that because this interesting stuff just smears into the oxygen band, and so you wouldn't be able to make a statement about it. So I want to argue to you, you already see how my mind is working, that disorder, there is disorder in the system. It's known that the sodiums tend to be disordered in this particular compound. I want to argue to you that it's a straightforward scattering model. It's really difficult to smear out part of the weight and have no K resolution and still have a dispersing peak that apparently defines a Fermi surface pretty nicely. So to me, it's attractive to think about models with fractionalization where there's the possibility for one excitation to be badly scattered and one excitation not. I have to say this is another idea that I got from Phil in the context of the high TCs, but I've tried to take it over to this system. And so the notion would be that you have a lot of charge disorder and the holon peak is smeared out. and is producing this background.
What is the resistivity of this compound?
Again, I'll actually show you that in a minute, and I think it even with a graph with scales on it, and maybe even for two axes. So I'll show you that in a second. I'm sorry, I really have the good answer to your question on this one. So the concept is spinons that don't see the charge disorder and disperse to define the chemical potential associated with an alpha value which is greater than less than a half to make something peaky, and then part of the spectral weight just smeared out, having to do with some excitation that cares a lot about the charge disorder. And then if I can, and then in that context, then the idea is that we do have a sharp MDC, that is, we see at the chemical, at the Fermi energy, we see the sharp peaks in K. But if I look at K equals K Fermi, and if you'll allow me to regard this as really part of the spectral function, then I certainly have a very spread out object with spectral weight all through the chemical potential. Notice, by the way, that if you try to invoke a Fermi liquid picture, I mean, you might say, oh, well, heck, you know, in Fermi liquid theory, we have weight that's all spread out and background stuff. But here's a case where the peak lies out at 6/10 of an EV, say, but we have an enormous amount of weight up to higher or to lower energy nearer the chemical potential. Hard to get that out of a simple Fermi liquid kind of picture. That's not what TITE2 looks like, for example. So I think this is a pretty interesting line shape if one will take it seriously. Yeah.
Maybe I would like to understand a bit better or clarify in what sense this thing is quasi-1D. In a real 1D system, there is only one Fermi velocity and consequently one spinon and holon velocity. Now here, probably in the non-interacting system, if you move along these straight Fermi lines, you will encounter different velocities all the time. And so if you somehow map this on some type of Lachenberg lipid thing, then you would probably have to average over many different velocities in order to take it.
I don't know how to map this onto a toy model. So that's why I tried to put forward a kind of framework in which I would step back from these toy models and say, what kind of features could I look for? And so that's the flow of the ideas.
Yeah, but I wanted to say, even if you take sort of the simplest mappings on some sort of Luttinger Likert model, then the least one should do, I think, is sort of average over different velocities, because you have different Fermi velocities even in the non-interacting thing. And this would sort of smear out peak features, at least a little bit. Maybe it smears out larger the holon part, the spinon part, so I don't know.
I too don't know. I mean, I'm at the outer limits of what I would know to say. But we've gone from saying that we don't like these line shapes and we don't understand them very well, and I wish that they were nicer, to saying maybe nature's trying to really tell us something about this system, that you have sharp things and smeared out things all at the same time. And there's a lot of underlying one-dimensionality in the system.
Well, it seems to me the sharp thing is at low energies, and the broad thing is at high energies.
At low energy, the broad.
Well, not so. I mean, it's a dispersive peak that moves like this all the way across the whole bandwidth.
Right.
And it's like a sail that rides on top of a sea. A sort of a sea of K-independent weight, which is something like half the weight.
Right, so you have an incoherent part and then a quasi particle peak on top of that.
No, because
well,
the compound disperses.
A little bit, but it disperses less.
But not a quasi particle peak, surely, because then you will have trouble explaining why the weight at up near the Fermi level when the peak is down here.
If you have the top figure, the top, and then over that there is just a peak more.
Right.
It's like that. Now, I want to compare the sodium purple bronze line shapes that I just showed you to a high TC system and argue to you they are remarkably similar. This is data from Dessau in 93 PRL from his thesis work. And I took it because this particular paper was really upfront about these features in the line shape. And they say in there there's a K-independent background and we don't know what it is. It might be this, it might be that. And in this particular case, the oxygen bands start coming in immediately. So you don't have a chance to know whether this is about to go back to zero again, like you do in the in our particular example of the sodium bronze, where you see this weight fall to zero as soon as you get outside the bandwidth, and that's how you know it's not photoemission extra scattering. So I would like to suggest to you that you again have here a dispersing object with an alpha that corresponds to a number that is maybe greater than zero but less than 0.5, moving on a k-independent background. And of course, it's this kind of data that caused Anderson to make his remark to me a few years ago that perhaps there's something fractionalized in these spectra with a lot of disorder. I wouldn't know how to get this out of theories, and a lot of times when I present this to theorists, they say, but we know very well and good what disorder does in a Tominaga-Luttinger model, and it messes up fractionalization and it mixes the spin charge channels, and yeah, I think that's probably true.
If you try to analyze the background in terms of density of states and the Fermi function, you review the density of states final to the Fermi energy of zero. So this kind of background is something having really weight on this. You are.
I guess what I know about it is what we can see here. It seems, I wish I had data on the other side of the chemical potential, I guess is what my gut level feeling would be, to say, oh, well, let's measure here, but we haven't been very successful in measuring. I don't think I have a clean answer to your question right now. What if I could give you an answer, then what would you say next? I mean, suppose I said, yes, it falls to zero, or suppose I said, no, it doesn't, what would you then respond?
No, I don't know. Can be somehow states which are disordered states, or something which is essentially some kind of disordered states inside the system. So there is a density of disordered states, which somehow is different to say that you have disorder or something which is dispersed. There is on you have the surface and so on. So there is a background which has nothing to do with what you are looking. It's just a background because there are states around which are more or less dispersed everywhere. So yeah. We would expect that these kind of states will not have a gap, and then will be just some states everywhere.
Those states do know what the line width, do know what the bandwidth of my dispersing object is. They and so in that sense, they aren't just some other kind of states. It would appear to me. Well, there were some early ideas put forth actually by Zabotsky and by our group in which we looked at the Olson data with a viewpoint to these line shapes, and we tried to fit them with marginal Fermi liquids and Fermi liquids, but we were willing to remove some background. And it turns out that by the standard prescriptions for how to take out inelastic backgrounds, I don't take you through all this, but just kind of concentrate on this part. If you do what we think we know how to do in photoemission to remove inelastic scattering line widths, then the size of the background you have to take out is by 15 times larger than you should have to take out actually to fit the entire valence band in order to get the marginal Fermi liquid. Of course, it has a tail that falls off like 1 over E. If you want Fermi liquid, which falls off like 1 over E squared, then you got to take out something that's sort of 60 times bigger than you could stand up in front of a photoemission audience and feel comfortable about saying I did that. Although I have to say that now there are some fits in the literature of high TC line shapes in which substantial well, here are some resistivities. So let's see. Oh, curses. It's arbitrary units again on that one. Let's see. Here's the blue bronze. So this is 10 to the minus 3 ohm centimeters. So these are pretty big numbers. I'm sorry. These are plots where what they wanted to show us. Or maybe it was hard to make the measurements. I actually don't know. Let's see. This one is ohm centimeters. 0 to 1 here. So this is parallel and perpendicular for the quasi 2D system. And here's the CDW transition. So this is the resistivity going up, presumably because you've truncated the Fermi surface. That would be the traditional understanding.
From these one sees that they are pretty bad metal.
Yeah, but they're not quasi 1D. I mean, they're both metallic in both directions.
And that's certainly true. They are not quasi-1D, they are quasi-2D, and then, of course, the Fermi surface has 2D topology.
Not even quasi-2D.
C-axis is the least...
The C-axis is perpendicular to the planes. So these are layered systems. Yeah, I should have said this. These are layered systems with the layers perpendicular to a C-axis, and then within the planes are laid out these three chains at 120 degrees to one another.
Yeah, not so, so even so 2D.
Correct. They sure cleave nicely. I probably don't have, I don't really have data that addresses the three-dimensionality of these systems. We have tended to treat them as 2D systems. Actually, there are now data that address the two-dimensionality of TITE2, and something like that could be done with these systems if one knew what to do about that. So those are the T-linear resistivities that show up in these systems. And look, so we have TITE2, which shows none of these signatures. It's a quasi-2D system, doesn't have a CDW. So far as we know, it's just a nice, harmless metal. I have a quasi-1D lithium purple bronze, which shows all my signatures, but I would note that one of those is the Anderson-Wren line shape, which really is not Tominaga-Luttinger, but somehow makes the Fermi surface special, rather than making the singularity move with these points. The blue bronze I didn't talk about, but it's missing two features moving that we can identify. On the other hand, it appears to be a spin gap system, and I don't know that there are really line shapes available that we could look at for that. I showed you the quasi-2D sodium purple bronze and tried to argue to you that it looks a lot like bismuth 2212 at the level of these line shape features that I care about. And that would, call it a melted holon with an alpha that's less than a half and a peaky spin on that's moving to define the chemical potential. And so that's it. Thank you for listening again to this.
Okay.
Thank you for
this
marathon.
Yeah, well, I said this would be more speculative, and I can see as we get further and further from models that you can really treat, of course it gets harder and harder. But on the other hand, I think that's what we've had to do to confront the data.
What's your point?